The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Welcome into the latest edition of ESPN FC. I'm Kay Murray, joined in the studio by Ali Moreno. We've got lots to talk about, and joining us to do so, we have Julian Laurent, Stevie Nichol, and also Jan Agafyotoft. And we're going to start by talking transfers. In fact, it's one club in particular. This one for you, Jules. It's a club that didn't win the league, nor the Champions League, but they are winning the race for signatures right now. They stole, it seems, Wijnaldum right under the claws of Barcelona. Gigi Donnarumma is set to join on a free transfer. And Ashraf Hakimi, reported to be leaving Inter, who we know do have to sell, to also be heading over to Paris. And here we have the PSG president, Nasser Al-Khelaifi, on Mbappe's future. He says, I'll be clear. Mbappe is going to stay in Paris. We will never sell him. He will never leave on a free. Mbappe has everything he needs in Paris. Where can he go? What club, in terms of ambition, can compete with PSG today? It seems there's been some unrest as well in Spain with these transfers, with reports like this, with quotes like this. So, Jules, let's talk about it. It's definitely a statement of intent, isn't it, from PSG?
It is. Nasser Al-Khelaifi doesn't often talk, but when he does, usually it's pretty good, and it was good in that interview from L'Equipe. You read the quote about Mbappe, but there were many more quotes that were interesting. One as well, that's saying that they will be very active this summer on the transfer market. They will have to sell as well to enable themselves to be very active. But certainly from what we've seen so far, Wijnaldum, although it's a free transfer, as we always say on the show, there's no free transfer. That doesn't exist. You pay a big signing on fee to the players, the Asian commission, of course, plus the wages, but still there's no transfer fee to pay for Wijnaldum. And even if he's 30 years old, it's a very good signing for them, even if they had to make a big offer financially to beat Barcelona for his signing. Gigi Donnarumma is more of an opportunistic one, because that was not really the plan ideally, to go for a goalkeeper, but because he's on a free again, and they can loan him out and wait for Keylor Navas to sort of finish his career in Paris, and then Donnarumma is the perfect replacement. That kind of made sense, although I'm not the biggest fan of that kind of deals. And then for Hakimi, it would be very expensive, and he's more of a wing back than a right back, but again, they need someone on that right hand side, and if they can get him for a decent amount of money, I think that would be a very good business again.
Ali, it seems as though they're a little bit concerned, particularly in the Spanish capital. Mm-hmm. Spanish sports dailies, of course, always have something to say. They've referred to PSG as the terror of the transfer market. Mm-hmm. Do you think that because of this, because of the financial power that they have, the power is shifting?
It's a financial power that they have, and the financial power that Real Madrid and Barcelona do not have. And that's where it falls apart for Barcelona and for Real Madrid, in that usually, when they come to the table, whether it's Barcelona and Real Madrid, if you just put a competitive offer on the table, most players would say, yeah, Barcelona, Real Madrid, above PSG. But when PSG comes over the top and says, this guy can't pay you what we can pay you, look, here's the numbers, flat out, Jorginho Wijnaldum, this is what you can get with us, this is what you can get with them. And if you're a player and you look at it and they're not competitive offers, regardless of what you may think of Real Madrid and Barcelona and whatever your dreams may have been, if the numbers don't make sense, you say, well, PSG all of a sudden becomes my dream destination. And this is the club where I've always wanted to be. Never mind the Spanish giants. The Spanish giants are what they are in name, but right now financially they cannot compete at the elite level.
Is that the reality of modern football then, Stevie?
Absolutely is. I always find it funny when teams like Barcelona, particularly Real Madrid, have they forgotten about the Galacticos? That was just a case of throwing money at everybody and getting all the best players, rounding them up and sticking them in one all-star team. So teams like Real Madrid can't complain about anything that PSG do. And yes, it's absolutely about the money because of the owners that PSG have, and of course Manchester City. then even though we've been through a pandemic, they still have money. And so that's just called being unlucky if you're Real Madrid, that you don't have any money. It's called not looking after your finances and your players and making better decisions. The same with Barcelona. That's what this is. Now they know what it's like on the other side.
Yeah, Jan, it's interesting, isn't it? Because that's one thing you would always see. Barcelona and Real Madrid did always seem to be the top choice for so many of the big players. And we're seeing perhaps a shift, as we're talking about. And that also points to it with Erling Haaland as well, because it doesn't look as though that's where he's going to end up.
Well, before I come to Haaland, I just want to say that there is a different thing now, because Real Madrid bought David Beckham for around £30 million. Now there are clubs, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, Barcelona, if we take all the clubs, are competing with these clubs who are sponsored by states. And UEFA tried to do the financial fair play. That didn't work. You remember that funeral they have at CAS when that verdict went for Manchester City. So financial fair play, great idea, didn't function at all. That's why it was quite surprisingly that the English club, seeing this, that Real Madrid, Barcelona, Juventus, they are in big trouble financially, and still them threw them this silly lifeline called Super League. Because that was what it's all about. That was to get more money to these clubs to survive. And yes, Kay, I agree with you. Now they'll see the other side, and Steve is right. They used to do this as well. As Al said, there is a lot of players now will say that Paris is the place you want to play, the place you want to be. In terms of Haaland, there is no chance that the Spanish giants, Barcelona, Real Madrid, will come up with the money. We are talking like 130, 140, 150 million euro. So there is no way that he will end up there now as we're speaking this summer.
Where's he going to go, Jan, this player?
Well, what we do know is that Chelsea works very hard to get him to London. He's seen as the missing link. He's seen as the missing player for them going as a title challenger into the next season. And we have to be realistic that the only two clubs who could get him in England would be Manchester City and Chelsea. If Haaland leaving Dortmund, they want to go to a place where they can win titles. And then we just have to see, where can they win titles? Sancho, we've got a gentleman's agreement with Sork that he can leave this summer. If deadline is met, which is supposedly 23rd of July when they go into training camp, Haaland is another story because his clause is efficient next summer. But still, if money comes in, Dortmund has played for 1 year, they played like everybody else without fans, and there is 81 of them, 81,000 every game in Dortmund. So they lost some money too. So it's going to be an interesting summer.
Jules, can you see that Erling Haaland going to Chelsea?
I think I can see it. It makes sense, and we've discussed it many times with Jan on the show, why Dortmund would want to keep him another year. We know that release clause will kick on in the following summer, in the summer 2022, for 75 million euros. And you keep him for a year because he can win you the title next season, almost on his own. And in that team with a new manager, they can win the title if you keep him. However, if Chelsea or Manchester City or someone else put 150 million euros on the table, so double the release clause that will kick in a year, then if you don't want, you have to think about it. You have to think about it because it's such an enormous amount of money that you can then reinvest and buy another striker or two or three even, and then still be hopeful that you can go and trouble Bayern Munich to try to win the title. It won't be the same, of course, but you will have to think about it. So it'd be very interesting, like Jan said, why Zorc and the club, Vatske and people there are going to do if that offer really comes on the table.
Jules, do you think the trend is shifting away from Spain then? And should Real Madrid and Barcelona fans be concerned?
I think Real Madrid can't forget as well what they did with David Alaba, because as Carlos Rummenigge reminded us not long ago, the offer that they made for Alaba to not accept the offer from Bayern Munich to stay at the club, which was already a lot of money, but they doubled the wages, exactly like PSG did with Wijnaldum. So they had the money then to be able to get Alaba away from Bayern Munich and away from a lot of other clubs, including PSG, because they offered what was, you know, really a crazy amount of money, 25 million a year gross, which is a lot of money for someone like who's going to turn 30 next year. So they can do it, Real Madrid, if they want to. This time it was PSG who did it to Barcelona. But I agree with with you and the boys, I think it's shifting a little bit because the debt, especially in Barcelona, is so big now that they don't have the sort of leeway that they used to have before. And Messi on his own now is not enough just to attract the players with less money than other clubs.
And isn't that part of the reason as to why Real Madrid and Barcelona are struggling? Because of the decisions you've made on signings and the fact that Bayern Munich valued this player at a certain amount of money, and you came over the top and you say, you know what? We may be struggling financially, but here you go. We're going to overpay you. Those sort of decisions keep happening for Barcelona and Real Madrid, and therefore this is why they've gotten themselves into trouble. And yet, seemingly, they're not learning. They continue to make the same mistakes. Well, then the struggles are going to continue to happen.
Yeah, and obviously then we know what they're hoping for with the old Super League.
Yeah.
And standing firm on that one too. Well, more transfer talk you can catch over on our website. Be sure to check everything out there to see all the latest rumours.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't a search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/FC. Just go to Indeed.com/FC right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the podcast. Indeed.com/FC, terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We're now just days away from England's opener in Euro 2020. Ahead of it, their friendly games have been marred by some fans booing the players when they take a knee before kickoff. Gareth Southgate, understandably concerned, says, "We accept that there might be an adverse reaction, but we're going to ignore that and move forward. I think those people should put themselves in the shoes of those young players and how they must feel. In essence, people are booing their own team. I don't really understand that." Well, joining me now to discuss this topic, we have Nader Manua, Alexis Nunes. We also have Shaka Hislop and Mark Ogden as well. Shaka, I'll start with you. Let's just recap as to why the English players and players in English football have been taking a knee before games.
Well, it started roughly a year ago, just after the death of George Floyd here in the US, and albeit an ocean away from what's happening in English football, it sparked a global calling for the recognizing of black lives and the equality of all of us, regardless of our differences. Football responded in recognizing what the world was asking for, what the world was having to endure and witness during the course of that pandemic. When we were all indoors, players started taking a knee as that became a universal symbol for that call for equality, and it continues. It's been hugely valuable, not just in highlighting the issues, but in initiating conversations in addressing those issues. Football felt that it was right for them to continue taking the knee, and then even as players started coming back into stadium, or fans started coming back into stadiums, you saw this adverse reaction to it. And while a lot of the focus has been on the booing and the adverse reaction, as I phrased it, I look at the response of the majority of fans who come out to games, who are determined to drown that out, determined to do their own part in recognizing the best of who we are. So while this is a topic that we will discuss and debate, I take real pleasure in seeing how the no longer silent majority has reacted.
Yeah, well, let's hear this from Kick It Out's Troy Townsend, reiterating it's not a political statement. He says taking a knee was a gesture chosen by the players as a stance for greater racial equality in football. It's important to reiterate that they have said explicitly that it was not intended to be connected to any specific political movement. Nader, how do you think these players are feeling having their own fans boo them ahead of a game?
Yeah, to be honest, I think it must be very tough. I spoke with one of the players today, and he said he was shocked because for those guys who are doing that, they do believe that they're doing the right thing, and they're doing it in a way which shouldn't really cause controversy, because as we've sort of alluded to there, for the past year, people have had to be unequivocal in describing the reasons for doing exactly what they're doing. And, you know, even still, they're still having to, like, be questioned about it now. So when they go out there and they try and make a statement, try and show a unified message for something which objectively feels good, like, why should you be booed? You know, you've not done anything detrimental to the nation, to those groups of fans, but you're being booed for it. And I think for lots of them, they're left in a position whereby they're asking the question, well, why are they booing? Because we've explained multiple times, this is why we're doing it. So why do they still boo us now? And ultimately, I think there aren't enough microphones which are being put in the faces of the people who boo. Because very quickly, if they say something like, well, it's because they're aligned with this movement, it's political. Well, if somebody just says, just a quick fact check and says, no, that's not what it is, I bet there's no other line of the sort of argument for those people. And it's a shame because I don't think those players deserve that type of treatment. And, you know, these are guys who are honored to play for their country, but then they also understand their platform as well. And I think the fact that all of those guys are good enough to be able to go out there and try and make it a greater good for as many people as possible, you know, that isn't a problem. So it's a shame to see. And the sad thing is, you know, I'm like marking the fact that I saw a few games towards the end of the season. There's this thing in the back of your mind where you kind of expect it. But that's wrong, because for me, what you're seeing on the field is something which should be praised. And I think all those guys, to give them credit, this generation of England players who understand their social impact, you know, I think they should be praised. But instead, you know, they're being booed by a few, and unfortunately, you know, ends up being a talking point.
Yeah, of course. And as you say, it is a few. And obviously, as Shaka was saying, that there's a big group of people who are also supporting the players taking the knee. But Alexis, not just the England games, is it? Because you've been at the FA Cup final this season, you've heard those boos yourself there.
Yeah, exactly. We're at the FA Cup final game, and honestly, I was really taken aback by it because the boos were absolutely loud. And I remember I just put my head down because I didn't want to put a face to these boos, because I mean, Shaka can attest to it, Nadim can attest to it. Like, we've all had experiences with racism, and in the last year where we've seen so many improvements, especially in football, and we felt that we have even done stuff here at ESPN to try and educate people, to try and, as you would say, bring the horse to the water and almost force him to drink and understand why these players are doing this and why it affects us as people so horribly. It's shocking to see just the blatant ignorance and just the unwillingness for people to accept it. I was just in an Uber today and hearing on the radio they were talking about it, and just random people, fans, were calling in, and so many of them were saying that, you know, well, this is just an American thing, you know, why do we have to bring it over here? Or it's a political thing, you know, players should really just carry on playing the game. And there's such an unwillingness to sit down and really learn about why these players are doing this. And as Nadim said, he spoke to a player today. I've spoken to quite a few, some of which are going to play for England this weekend, some who have played in the Premier League and the Championship. And I think what they told me too, one of them said he was genuinely surprised, at least at the booing in the friendlies, because in the Premier League, maybe they wanted to think, okay, it's two opposing teams, it's clubs. But there's something special about putting on a shirt to represent your country, and there's something unifying with that, and it feels like it unites everybody no matter what color they are. And yet here they are booing their own players, booing players like Marcus Rashford, who 45 minutes later scores a penalty and all of a sudden everyone's out buying his shirt. And nobody, and the players just cannot seem to fathom that. In my case, I think of Jamaica, and there's a ton of players who are born and raised overseas that play for Jamaica. But when they put on that Jamaica shirt, I'm like, right, you're one of our own. I don't care where you were born. And I think that's so hard for the players to grasp. You could see them looking around, and I shudder to think how they must have felt going back home, putting their heads on a pillow, going to sleep, knowing that their own people are booing them for daring to stand up against racism.
Yeah, it's bewildering, isn't it? I mean, Mark, do you think this could be a distraction going forward? Because Alexis mentioned there as well that some are saying this is an American thing, this taking the knee, but we've seen racist tweets. We've seen that this is still very important, what these players are doing, what these players are calling for. Do you think it could end up being a distraction throughout the Euros for the England team?
Well, I don't think it's a secret that there's an obnoxious, ignorant element to the England support, and that has been for a long time, whether it's racism, whether it's, you know, the way that they behave with the national anthems of opposition teams, the way they chant about, you know, Irish history, the way they chant about the Pope. This isn't just purely related to what we've seen at the weekend. But for me, this vocal minority of people, you know, spouting this thing, it's a Marxism left-wing movement, that these are just phony excuses. And I think the England team, Gareth Southgate and the players, I think they're fed up of having to explain themselves. I think that is the issue. So it is a distraction that every press conference, they're being asked about this. And, you know, Gareth Southgate, the players have made it absolutely abundantly clear. This is not a political message. This is about players, teammates, wanting to stand side by side in support of players who, such as Raheem Sterling, Marcus Rashford, Kyle Walker, who've been on the end of racism, whether it's in stadiums, online. It's purely footballers standing up for the mates, the teammates. So this element of supporters that suggests that it's being, you know, phrases like ram down their throats, it's an absolute nonsense. So it is a distraction. And, you know, football supporters are supposed to be the 12th man, the extra help that gets them over the line. Well, that isn't the case with England. The England fans like to pride themselves on being some of the best supporters in the world. So, you know, they do travel well. But in this instance, they're not the best supporters in the world. They can be quite difficult to be around. You know, I was at a game in Germany in 2017. It was Lucas Podolski's farewell game for Germany. And the England fans booed throughout the national anthem, the German national anthem, and sang songs about the Second World War and the First World War and RAF bombers and German bombers. It was horrendous. And this is just an extension of that. This lack of education, I guess, of some of the people that watch in England that believe that this is the right thing to do. It's hard to explain. It really is. And it's very hard to justify. But this is something that football fans that follow the England team, there is a minority that constantly let the team down, let the country down.
Shaka, as Nader mentioned, it is the highest honour to play for your national side. These players should not have to be going into games with this in their mind, should they?
No, they shouldn't. They absolutely shouldn't. And I think it's detesting that they have to deal with this from a group of their own fans, and they hear it, and they're put off and set back by it. Yes, representing your country is the highest honor there is in the game. But then when for all the pride that you feel in pulling on the shirt, in wearing your national team's colors, to then feel that you are representing a section of that population, of that fan base, even if it is a minority, you're representing them when they don't believe that you are worthy of the fullest of human rights. You are worthy of being called equal to them and others who you share the football field with. And that is a really tough kind of duality to live, where you are giving of yourself, giving everything of yourself in representing a country that some people don't think you are even worthy of that redress, and it's dispiriting to witness.
Well, thanks so much to all of you for joining us on a very important topic here on ESPN FC. We do hope that these boos will stop. A reminder that England's campaign gets underway on Sunday when they take on Croatia. This is their Group D, which they also share with the Czech Republic and Scotland. Did you know less than 10% of Americans own an e-bike? Here's why that should change. Studies show e-bike owners actually end up exercising more, plus getting outside more. If you're looking for a balanced lifestyle and everyday adventures, you need to check out Lectric e-bikes. They are the number one selling e-bike brand in America. Their bikes are typically foldable, pre-assembled, and have serious range up to 150 miles on some models. Check them out today at electricebikes.com and add some more adventure to your week. That's electricebikes.com. France in friendly action against Bulgaria. The talking point coming from this one, though, was Karim Benzema coming off in the 31st minute. He landed awkwardly. The hope is that he's okay, as he did sit out and watch the rest of the game. Giroud came on for him, though, and did score two of those goals. Griezmann with the first of them. But lots to discuss, and fortunately, we have many people to discuss this team with us. Stevie, Jules and Jan here with us. Let's start with you then, Jules. What's going on with Benzema? Is he OK?
Yeah, I'm being told it's a dead leg. He got that knock on that corner that we've just seen. And I think they didn't want to take any risk. It was really by precaution. He didn't even have to go back to the dressing room. He watched the end of the first half and then the second half in the stands with the other subs. So I don't know how long it will take for him to don't feel it anymore, or if he can play with just a little bit of pain without having a risk that he gets worse or anything like this. But Deschamps and the staff, and especially the medical staff, didn't seem that worried about the injury that he picked up in that first half.
Stevie, obviously we know how dangerous they are. What did you make of them in this performance?
Do you know what? I actually really enjoyed watching it. You know, normally friendlies are not particularly great, but because how good the French are and because the tournament's coming up and what for them in a week's time they play, then you could see everybody had a little skip in the step. You know, some nice little interchanges with Griezmann and Benzema and Pogba and Mbappe. I mean, I just enjoyed watching it. And they probably should have been three up at half time, in my opinion. I mean, certainly possession wise, they were completely dominant. And again, no question, they're favourites. Great to watch, and a great performance, I thought.
Jules, as a Frenchman, were you happy with what you saw?
Yeah, I was happy. I think Stevie summed it up well. I am a bit worried at times by the lack of depth because they play with a diamond in midfield and Griezmann as a 10 behind Benzema and Mbappe when they have the ball. They move to a 4-3-3 when they don't have the ball, which is far more solid and more balanced to defend and to try to get the ball back. But the fullbacks will have to do a lot of work and be there very present wide to use that width, the lack of width in that first half. At times it was very central, and that those interchanges that Stevie was talking about are great sometimes, but it's easier to defend than if you use all the width of the pitch. So the fullbacks will have to do that because there's no wingers in that team, of course. But I thought there was a lot of really good things. They should have scored more. It's very good for Giroud to score two, even if he probably won't start against Germany in a week time. And Mbappe looked a little bit frustrated when he came off with 10 minutes to go or something because he didn't score again. But it's another goal for Griezmann. Defensively, it's the fourth game in a row without conceding, so they're solid, which they've always been. But then you've got that bit of flair and a bit of magic with Pogba and N'Golo Kante coming back in the team as well, who I thought did well until the hour mark, and Tolisso, I thought, going for strength to strength too in midfield.
Yeah, so all positive signs for France. This is the group of death that they are in, favourites of course, for Hungary, Portugal and Germany. And the first game for them is against Germany. It's in Munich. It's on Tuesday. There are a fear for some, Jan, that Germany won't even make it out of this group. What do you think of those fears?
Well, they could maybe get out of one of the best four third. But having said that, Germany knows that this is the last chance also for Joachim Löw to do well there. But I'm very impressed by France, not only the individual players they have there, but also the winning culture there is with Deschamps as the national coach is unbelievable. And I think that lacks a bit of in Germany, although they had a great result of scoring goals, getting self-confidence last night. But still, this is going to be a very difficult group for Germany. I think it's very important for them to start well against France. They could be hammered by France, as France is playing now with these players going forward. And we haven't even started talking about Giroud, who comes on again and scores two goals. He's five away from Thierry Henry's 51 all-time greatest goalscorer of France. I mean, what a humble, great, grisly kind of guy he is, Giroud, for them. So I think that Germany, with their defence, they will fear this France team. I think they are frightened about this. They will like to tend and say they have that all under control. I think they are scared of France coming 15th of June.
Stevie, what are you expecting from this game? And should Germany be careful?
Absolutely. I'm with Jan 100%. I don't see... You know, we sort of complained about France today because they couldn't break Bulgaria down, but the truth is, when you've got 10 men behind the ball, it is hard to break down. The Germans aren't going to do that. I mean, I don't think their pride would allow them to stick 10 men behind the ball and just try and be like a Mourinho-type side and do France on the break. And that means that there'll be more space for that front three, if Benzema's fit, to create havoc. So, yeah, I'm worried for the Germans. I mean, defensively, look, the Germans have got ability going forward. I don't think anybody would argue that. But defensively, I mean, the players they're relying on, the likes of Hummels, I mean, Dortmund were awful at the back and he was right in the middle of it all the time. He's the leader of the defence at Dortmund and you know he's starting. I mean, if Chan starts beside him, which Jürgen Klopp has done before, my goodness. So I just don't see how the Germans could cope with France defensively. I'm with Jan. I think this could be a one-sided game.
Jules, are you confident that your France can get off to a good start in this game?
Yeah, and they have to be, like we've been saying, they're so good, they're on good form. There's, apart from the little worry about Benzema, everybody is pretty much fully fit. Rabiot has a little niggle as well, but he will be ready in a week time. They're playing well, they're very solid. Benzema's integration after 5.5 years away from the national team has been perfect. And then you even have, in a way, Kylian Mbappe not really firing in the way it could be or should be. So it's all the lights are green for us. And we go into this game, even if it's away in Germany, with a lot of confidence, knowing that we can win that game like we did in 2016, for example, in the semi-final of that Euros, previously when we played them in Marseille.
What a game to look forward to coming up next week, where Euro 2020 gets underway on Friday. Turkey, Italy kicks things off. And then Spain against Lithuania, essentially an under-21 side. Just one of the players in this team actually had a cap. And this is because of the situation that's going on. The whole team isolated after Sergio Busquets has tested positive for COVID. So it's worth keeping an eye on what's going on with Spain ahead of their game with Sweden next week. They are calling off what's called a parallel squad just in case more positive tests come from the camp. But so far, the players have been testing negative. Julien Laurent is with us now. Once again, on the eve of a major tournament, there's a lot of doubts over this Spain side. So what's the latest with the first team, Jules, and that COVID test?
Yeah, it's a big mess, to be honest, Kay. They're all self-isolating. Sergio Busquets, of course, who is the one who tested positive on Sunday, he's doing fine. I don't think there's many symptoms, or certainly not very serious. But everybody has to self-isolate. Players are training on their own. They're all in Las Rosas, where the Federation HQ is, where they usually train. And they're waiting. They're waiting for tomorrow, Wednesday, when they will have the vaccine. They've been sort of like hushing in to get the vaccine and in priority. And then they will do more tests and hope with their fingers crossed and their legs crossed and their toes crossed that no other players will test positive. They formed a parallel bubble with players like Raul Albiol and Kepa and Rodrigo, who will be there training just in case they need to call up other players in case there's more positive tests, really. It's a mess. We still don't know if Sergio Busquets will be able to be part of the squad for the Euros. And even if other players who might test positive later and tomorrow, the day after, so far they're all negative today, but there's a huge question mark and huge weight on all that staff shoulders, really. Their game is against Sweden on Monday night, and that doesn't leave you much time in case something else happens.
There are some very nice just in case players for Spain, but it's not ideal, is it, Ali, heading into a tournament like this?
It is not ideal. And in the best of circumstances, this team of Spain coming into this tournament would have had some questions, things that they needed to answer. They needed to be at their very best, and they were going to need some help from other people in order for them to really be a true contender in the competition. This is not ideal. This is not the best of circumstances. And so you imagine what Luis Enrique is going through right now. I'm sure him and his staff had a whole training regime put together and a package of things that they wanted to do ahead of their first game in terms of their preparation. And all of that preparation, they just went, uh-oh, well, that's not good. That doesn't work for anything, because that was supposed to be with the whole team. Now we're having to put together individual training sessions. And the one thing that all coaches, all international coaches complain about is the fact that they don't have enough time to train with a group of players, to have the group of players so that you can create an identity, so that you can create patterns of play. This was the time in which Spain could have and would have used in order to be able to create that identity, in order to create those patterns of play. Now that's not happening. And so you go into this first game hoping for the best, hoping that you can put things behind you, and you're just going to rely on the talent that you have out on the field and say, guys, figure it out. Do your best, figure it out, and try to create some momentum, try to create some positive energy. Let's make the best out of a bad situation. That's not the way to walk into a major tournament, but that's what Spain has in front of them.
Meanwhile, you wonder if some of the Spanish nationals on their holiday have turned their phone onto silent so they don't have to answer that call. Anyway, more bonus material and more Euro content over on our YouTube page. Check out ESPN FC for all of that. Passion, drive and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights and more. Whether you're into speed, power or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Our writers at ESPN have been picking their best Euro moments. Make sure you check that out over on the website. Today, it's Gab Marcotti's turn. And we've also got Nader Manoa joining us to talk about what Gab's chosen, which is the Balotelli game in Euro 2012 against Germany. Might be a silly question, but why this one, Gab?
Well, it's Italy and it's Germany. I know everybody loves to think they're Germany's biggest rival, but, you know, there's only one country which has won as many World Cups as Germany in Europe. So I think Italy can legitimately claim that. They went into this Germany game. Germany, I think, had won every single game to that point. Italy had only won one game. They'd beaten England in the round before on penalty kicks with another Panenka, by the way, from Andrea Pirlo. And, you know, here you have Balotelli and Cassano up front, the dysfunctional duo. Balotelli scores the first one, a header set up by Cassano. On the second one, it's a ball over the top from Montolivo, I think, of all people. Philipp Lahm, the guy who never makes a mental error, gets absolutely stranded, leaves him onside, and then Balotelli gets it, lets the ball bounce, one touch, and he just rifles it past Manuel Neuer. And then the celebration, shirt off, 2-0, game over, flex. And, you know, at the time, Balotelli was still 21 years old. And, you know, it left you wondering, my goodness, what can this guy achieve in the next 10 years?
And Nader, at that point, your path had already crossed with Mario Balotelli. Do you remember watching these goals?
Yeah, I do, actually. I really do. And I think especially given the game before when he was coming up against some of his Man City colleagues while playing for England, you know, you were always checking to see how he was going to perform. But with Mario, to be honest, in that time when he was at City, as Gabriel's mentioned there, he was really, really young, but he was a really, really good guy and his talent was undeniable. I think, you know, there was a lot of potential, a lot of hope around that time thinking what could have been. But, you know, obviously it's not necessarily cracked on from there, but he's still a very, very top player. And that moment there, I do remember that very clearly. And it's an iconic moment. It's an iconic moment. I don't think everybody is in the same sort of shape to be able to do that celebration for the second goal. But it's definitely something that people remember. And to be honest, you look at the first goal and you knew it meant something to him because he celebrated. And this is the guy who said there's no point celebrating as a striker because all you're doing is your job.
Yeah, it's interesting though, obviously, because you've come into such close quarters with him, Nader. What was the talent like to see up close?
Yeah, spectacular. He was as good as anybody that was there. You know, in terms of mentality and stuff, you could buy him some time for saying he was young. But ultimately, I think at times for City, that group of players, they were very, very talented. But I think more of them had the greater desire to try and improve. Whereas for Mario, his talents basically put him in a place whereby he believed, you know, this is who he is. You know, there'd be times when he'd have debates with people about, you know, someone might mention Messi or Ronaldo or whatever. And he's having a serious debate with them saying, I'm as good as level of confidence there. You know, it took him so far. But as I say, he is incredibly talented. And at that time, you could see as a young prodigy why City brought him in. And obviously, it didn't necessarily work out in the long term, but he's had plenty of big moments from that point. And he was really, really good to be playing with and playing against in that short period because he was a very, very special player.
As Nader mentioned, Gab, there were big moments from that point. He was just 21 then. But was that, in hindsight, the pinnacle of his career?
I mean, you could look at probably that whole period. You know, I think a lot of people look back at him at City and describe him as a bust. Well, you know, I think they kind of ignore the fact that before even getting to City, he did win a treble with Inter. You know, he does have a Champions League medal at home. He won an FA Cup where he was man of the match. He scored two goals in the 5-1 at Old Trafford against Manchester United. That's pretty important. He set up Aguero for that goal in 93 minutes and 20 seconds, which gave City their first title since 1967, I want to say. So, you know, he did all those things with City. And he scores two goals to send Italy through to a European final. That is a lot. That is a high achievement. Obviously, from there, he struggled. And you know, I've known him and his family, you know, since he was 19 years old. And you know, there were always going to be concerns about, you know, he was either going to become a world-beating superstar and maintain that level, or things really risked, you know, going off the rails. And they probably have to some degree. But I think it's also good to look back and say, A, most people around him, and maybe the ones who don't have to work with him, find him generally to be a good guy. And, you know, he did achieve a whole bunch of things in his career, most of it at a very young age, admittedly.
Yeah, obviously, from what Nadim's saying as well, what he was like to be around. Were you surprised with all that in mind, Nadim? Were you surprised with how it did turn out and so many people thinking what could have been with Mario Balotelli?
I'm not sure. I think it's an example of somebody who does have an extremely great level in terms of talent from a very, very young age. But ultimately, that level of talent at that young age doesn't guarantee success for the future. And he obviously did work hard, but at that highest level, there are people who are always going to be working harder than you. And I think if he would have maybe, you know, had that sort of mentality from a younger point, then maybe he could have had a lot more great moments from, say, 2012, 2013, because obviously he's a very, very good player. But, you know, you can have comparisons with him, people who were doing just as well as he was from that young age, and they did manage to find the way to kick on. But still, his talent was absolutely undeniable, and it was a shame. But then also, you could argue that when he was at Man City, one of the worst things could happen to him was the fact that Mancini was there, because Mancini really loved him like a son. So in some ways, you know, if Mario wasn't necessarily giving it 100% at any particular moment, the manager was kind of just putting his arm around him and saying it's okay, when in fact he probably needed the exact opposite. So in that sort of key moment, it kind of springboards that next stage in his career. But as we said, his talent was and is absolutely undeniable, and it was a pleasure to play with. It was very, very tough to play against, and who knows, his time's not done yet. Who knows what's ahead?
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that, what it was like to play against him, even in training sessions, what it was like to come up against him.
He was a really, really good finisher. You know, at times he wouldn't necessarily be trying to get involved with the ball all the time and stuff like this, but every time he did, you could just see his quality shining through. He was brilliant at just sort of getting you one-on-one, finding a way to go past you. He was a really good finisher, and as we've seen with his penalties, you know, he rolls the ball into the goal like there's no joy for it whatsoever, and he would do that with his finishing as well. And when the guy says, literally, scoring goals is just my job, the way that he would do it would make it seem like it was a really mundane task, whereas for somebody else like myself, you score a goal, it's the best day ever. For him, he knows his ability, he knows how to finish. And I just wish he would have enjoyed it just that little bit more, because he scored in so many iconic games and had so many big moments. But yeah, in terms of what he was like to play against, he was tough, and he was really, really intelligent in the way that he would move and manipulate the ball. And I think he's probably still got that to this day, but maybe not necessarily that sort of rawness that he had back then, which almost made him at times unmarkable.
It's a wonderful moment in his career that you've chosen Gab here, but it obviously didn't turn out the way that Italy would have hoped to, coming up against Spain in that final. And you just remember those emotional scenes from Balotelli as well, and just what it meant to him.
Yeah, look, I mean, that final 2012, Italy in that whole tournament under Prandelli decided that they were going to play short passing. They were going to try to do some of what was then called tiki-taka. You can't do it against that Spain team at that time. I mean, this was a Spain side that, of course, won the World Cup in 2010. They were the reigning European champions as well. They were just so much better. And, you know, that final in Kiev, it was 4-0. It was an absolute beatdown. And Italy were always the underdogs. But, you know, you take what you can get. And, hey, you beat Germany and you got to a final, which is not a bad return. You know, losing to the reigning world and European championships at the end, you can live with that.
not a bad return at all. And great to have you both to speak about Mario Balotelli. Thanks, guys. Listen, there's a lot of excitement about Italy going into Euro 2020. It begins Friday. It kicks off with Turkey against Italy. Be sure not to miss it.
Picture this. You arrive at your hotel. You have an important online meeting lined up with clients from all across the country. You have your laptop open, ready to begin, and the Wi-Fi is so terrible, you can't even connect. These types of stressful situations happen all the time, but they don't have to. When you book a room at La Quinta by Wyndham, you have access to their free high-speed Wi-Fi, so you can take care of those critical emails, join your meetings on time, and even unwind by streaming your favorite shows without having to worry. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Thank everybody for joining us on the show today, but stick around for extra time to find out why Shaka might be just a little bit like Neymar in the hair department.
Neymar?
Neymar.
Shaka?
You have to
watch.
Welcome into Extra Time. I have to apologize at the top of the show because apparently on Extra Time the other day I called it a full house and I was reprimanded on Twitter because they said it's never a full house without Ali Moreno.
Oh, well, people do love me, Kate. Now, these guys don't love me, but people do love
me. Yeah, all three of them. Anyway, Shaka, Ale, Jan, and Nathan.
Ooh, speaking of that, Jan in Extra Time with me. He has shown in the past that he hates me. Not that he doesn't like me, that he hates me. And thank goodness you're here, Kay, because when it's me and Dan, Jan does not like it at all.
Jan,
Kay,
you have the right to reply.
Who is this guy next to you? I've never seen him before.
Well, he is a fan favorite here on Extra Time.
Only he can be here for a full house.
First question for Ale. If Lionel Messi has an outstanding Copa America campaign, is that enough for Argentina to win the Copa America?
No. And here is why. Lionel Messi has had great tournaments in the past with Argentina, and it hasn't been enough. He had a great World Cup in 2014. Was that enough? Not quite. There isn't enough help around him. Now, he could have a great tournament, they could make a deep run, and it's really going to depend as to what happens with Brazil, because according to Casemiro, Brazil is not going to play Copa America. So we shall see.
Okay, we shall see. We'll move on, actually, as well, to talk about hairstyles.
Ooh, okay.
Dan the Orange Man.
All right, I'm good with this.
I'm going to start with you, Nadim. He says, after Foden copied Gascoigne's blonde haircut, which current or former player's haircut would you copy?
Oh, my goodness. At the age of 34, turning 35. I don't know. I'll tell you what I liked. I like Reece James's change-up for the Champions League final, and it seems to energise him. So if that's the same for me, I'd do exactly the same thing.
Let's go along, all of you, for this one. Jan, who are you going to copy?
Well, I got a son who was a big fan, or is a big fan, of David Beckham. And he, from when he was 7 till he was 12, every haircut. So I would have probably, at that time, done David Beckham. I'm in concern of Phil Foden. I'm not sure if I love it or I hate it. I haven't decided yet, but I love the praise he had for Paul Gascoigne over 96 euros, so I think I will love it.
Jan, what about the cornrows? The David Beckham cornrows?
he didn't go there. He didn't go there. He stopped.
Okay.
He stopped when he took everything. He went bald, then he stopped. I stopped him.
Yeah, good. Well, that's good to hear. Let's go along then. Shaka, what about you?
I can see myself very Neymar-esque.
What?
Oh.
What? Hey, there is nothing Neymar-esque about you, Shaq. Nothing.
I'm just saying, I can pull it off, Ali. I'm feeling it.
Oh, you can feel it all you want, but you're not going to pull it off.
You can feel it in your finger.
Ali, haircut that you'd copy?
Because I don't have many options, you see, Kay. Hair is not something that I have plenty of. So I would suggest that maybe I would go with the Ronaldo look from 2002 World Cup.
Right.
Maybe that's something that I can recreate. Yeah, a little something.
Was that the worst haircut ever? Worst haircut ever.
Yeah.
Can I recommend either Wayne Rooney or Antonio Conte for Ali? I think that's needed.
Yeah, but that's going to take some time, Shaq. It's going to take some time.
No.
I'm just saying.
It would, okay.
You can plug a few holes. Let's just leave it at that.
I think you're looking great, Ale. Anyway,
well, thank you, Kay.
Madame Bascotta says, for Ale, don't you think Barcelona should try to sell Griezmann and look for a long-term striker? He's neither a winger nor a striker, and surely he can't dribble.
Well, so I'm going to get that Madame Bascotta doesn't like Griezmann all that much.
I guess not.
The decision to bring Griezmann to begin with was incorrect by Barcelona because there was no place for him to play. He wanted to have the Messi role, and as long as Messi is there, he's not having that role. And so he's trying to find his place in this team and hasn't quite succeeded. But there is no market really out there for Antoine Griezmann. And by the way, other teams around the world know that Barcelona are desperate to find some sort of business partner. And because of that, they are going to push Barcelona to the limit to where Barcelona ends up losing anyway. So if you're Barcelona, you're kind of saying, you know what, we're just going to have to make the best of what we got, and Antoine Griezmann is part of that package.
Okay, I'm going to give you a this or that again this time, Shaka, like I did the other day, but you don't have to be too biased in this one. Kevin Nguyen says, between Spurs and Everton, which job opening is more appealing and why?
Ooh. I think Spurs. I just think, and I have a feeling I'll be abused for this, I think Spurs is a bigger club of the two. I think it's a more attractive proposition. They're one of the traditional big six, though they haven't really enjoyed that position for the last couple of seasons. Between the two, I think that's the one that more managers would lean toward.
Nadim, Spurs or Everton, which for you?
I'd have to agree with Shaka. I think especially given the fact that Spurs have made it into the Champions League before, and at this moment in time they still have one Harry Kane, I think that would ultimately be more appealing to me. And adding the fact that right now Tottenham are doing better than Arsenal, whereas in Liverpool, I think Liverpool are probably going to be the dominant force there over Everton for a long time to come. So I think Spurs is probably the more appealing one at this moment in time.
Jan, would you rather be dealing with Daniel Levy in the big week to Everton?
I think that the big challenge for any leader or any manager to go to Tottenham would be to get a winning culture into the club. It's easy to make the options of who you like or biggest club or whatever. I remember in the 80s where Everton were fantastic with Howard Kendall and so on. But I think that the biggest challenge to go to Tottenham Hotspur is to find that winning culture, a culture that can win them titles. And I think that is a big challenge for a lot of managers around.
Your question about Daniel Levy. So I was watching the Amazon Prime video special on Spurs. And one of the takeaways that I had with that is, how could anybody work for this guy? It's just annoying. Meddling, interfering, all over the place, talking to the coaches every morning, having breakfast with them. It's like, dude, let me do my job. Let me work, all right? You just take care of the other stuff. I'll do the work on the field. So to that end, I would suggest maybe Everton, simply because whatever you do with Everton, Carlo Ancelotti walked there, won a couple of games, like, yes, yes, yes. Whatever you do with Everton seems to be, whatever you gain seems to be a big deal. So therefore, I think there's much more to gain with Everton than there is with Spurs.
Nadim, you wanted to come back in.
Yes, I did, yeah, because I fell off the fence for a second, but I need to jump back on. And one thing I need to say is that as far as Everton goes, it's an incredible family club. So depending on what the manager is, you know, they might want to be part of that environment or go into a more high-pressure one where you do deal with Daniel Levy and deal with more of an expectation of winning things, even if it doesn't work out. But I have to give Everton credit because everybody that's played there, they've said they've loved it. So that is a very attractive proposition.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I also want to say, Kay, to Al.
Big old jump back on that fence.
And I think that Al's point is there to leave it, but I think that what we will find in the international football is that they are all mad in those positions. This is the only guy who's shown it the reality TV. So I think there is some mad guys around, except Gibson at Middlesbrough. He's a decent guy.
Oh, yeah, he is. The Middlesbrough chairman, Steve Gibson. Sir Steve Gibson. Funnily enough, that leads us perfectly to the next question, Jan. Busted Spike says, what is Jan's favourite memory of the Borough? And that could be more than just a team.
Yes, I was lucky to come to Middlesbrough at a time when everything just exploded. It was a revolution up there. And I remember driving past Riverside Stadium every day, and they said, well, he's going to be ready for the Chelsea game, and so on and so on. and nobody believed it. And then suddenly we were there. We beat Chelsea in that first game. I scored a Buzz Aldrin goal, being the, after Craig Hignett did the first. And it was also great, the first game with Juninho. Juninho is a folk hero, he's a legend, he's a Harry Potter for Middlesbrough. And it was a fantastic game against Leeds United. I was fortunate enough to score that goal with a pass from Juninho, and that was a fabulous day. Kay, were you there?
Of course I was there, Jan. But yeah, you know what I did hear? Do you know what I did hear? Yeah. I heard that down the road in Newcastle, there was a goalkeeper who was very jealous and wished that he'd got, wished that he'd signed for Middlesbrough instead of Newcastle.
Of course, of course, yeah. Of course.
Was there? None of the other goalkeepers told me that.
Nadim, have you got any memories from Middlesbrough?
I was just about to say, Kay, after Jan said he went to Middlesbrough at a good time, there's never a good time to go to Middlesbrough.
Wow.
There's just a less bad time.
Wow.
Shaka.
Shaka, you should. Yeah, I would hide if I were you as well, Shaka. We do have Middlesbrough fans watching this. Nadim, any Borough memories?
Yeah, I've got a couple. One for the Borough fans was when they beat City 8-1, but I wasn't playing, so I'm not going to mention that one. But in terms of a big game between the two of us when I was at City, it was 2005, the last game of the season. And if we won, we would have qualified for the UEFA Cup. But if Borough didn't lose, then you'd make it there. And in the game, I remember my old manager, as it turned out to be, Jim Ford Hasselbank, hit a free kick from 30 yards out. And then from there, we were pushing. We had two goalkeepers on the field at the same time for us. I think we scored as well to make it 1-1. And then the last minute, Robbie Fowler had a penalty to send us into Europe, which he missed, and he never misses penalties. But lo and behold, the next season, you guys make it to the UEFA Cup final. And I was just left thinking, I wonder if that could have been us. But yeah, that's a strong memory I have of that particular Middlesbrough side in that game, because you guys were a good team. I'll give you credit where it's due.
Funnily enough, it's a strong memory I have as well of that game, but I think I have a better recollection of it than you do, Nader. Anyway, that will do it for the latest edition of Extra Time. Thank you so much to all of you for joining us. Thank you for your questions. And sorry to those of you who were upset that I called the last one a full house without
I was here. I was here, people. It's all right. It's okay. I'm back, baby.